This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your host, Chris Spangle. Joining me, as always, is the other host, Greg Lenz.
Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm well. Mittens is already climbing all over me.
That is the third co-host for today's midday show.
She's rubbing on the microphone for you people. Yeah, it's because the only time I'm one of those, I don't sit down a lot. I used to sit down all the time. Now I'm never not sitting. I'm always up and doing stuff. So one of the few times that I ever sit down for 2 hours is this. So she's all over me.
I know. She just can't get enough. Like the last three times we've recorded, she has been attacking you, basically.
Well, we'll ask her heated opinions on Ferguson later, I'm sure.
She looks angry.
So she would have been right there with him knocking over water glasses.
Well, you did get free kitty litter out of Nuck and cat toys.
You are on fire with the memes, sir.
I can't claim credit. Last night, you raiding the burning CVS with the kitty litter and the cat toys. That one was me, but I was like, oh, he's asleep, so I'm not sure this should go out. But I thought, what the hell? We'll put it out there. And then, though, you sent me the idea for the loot player.
Oh, yeah. So somebody posted, I guess it's a famous painting of this. Let's call him Man with a Loot.
Han something. Someone knew who he actually was.
Lauren Lowry. Shout out to Lauren down in Cincy. And he's got a lute, a 19th, I don't know, 16th century guitar, essentially.
The kind of guy that hung out with Descartes.
Right. Yes. And so it said, I was disappointed when I showed up to Ferguson at 5 p.m. for a looting session.
Oh.
And so you masterfully photoshopped my face on the picture, and it looks fantastic.
And now you are on the verge. And at this point, you may be there. I'm not sure. I haven't checked. But you may have finally become an internet icon and memer.
Greg has one goal in life. He's a simple man.
I'm a simple man. I'm a Quaker.
If you listen to this podcast, you know Greg's simple. Especially Roger Paxton. He thinks you're very, very simple.
I'll liberate him later.
And his goal in life is apparently to make me an internet, like, grumpy cat.
Exactly.
Thing. Yeah.
Well, more like, I mean, sort of like a bad luck Brian.
Greg wants to make me viral.
I do. I want to make you viral.
He's been trying to make me viral for several months.
Not a
now.
Virus, which libertarians, you know, we kind of are like a virus, but I want to make you viral. And a internet celebrity.
So you were so excited today when that one started getting a bunch of shares. So go check out our Facebook page, We Are Libertarians. Search it.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, I mean, we have over 6,000 Facebook fans.
As of now, we're right on the verge of 6,700.
If only all those people knew there was a podcast.
They'll get there. They will get there. It's much easier to click like than it is to download and listen.
I know. I may have to have you make a meme for this podcast so people will listen to it. hell, nobody's listening anyways.
That's all right. That's all right. We probably feel like Mike Brown's family. No one's listening anyways.
We actually went to a high school with a guy named Mike Brown. And football player, really good dude. And like when Mike Brown, it was announced that he was killed, I was like, oh man, that's a bummer. I saw the picture. I was like, oh, different Mike Brown.
No big deal. You saw all the Plainfield people with the, you know, hands up, don't shoot, and you just assumed that he got shot in the mean streets of Plainfield.
Yeah, so which is a suburb of Indianapolis. So every time I hear the Mike Brown, I think of Mike and him. So
he's alive and doing well.
He is very well, very well. He does very well. I have a bit of a cold. I'm getting over a cold, to be more accurate. I had a 7-day flu cold. Who knows what it was? I could barely talk.
Get any penicillin shots?
No, but I'm a little phlegmy. I'm a little, my voice isn't up to its normal half strength that it normally is.
You know, though, it sounds kind of deep, and you know, it's you've got a little Barry White going on.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hello, ladies. See, whenever you talk like, hello, I'm talking really deep in my head right now, I sound no different than I do right now.
No, you do. You do. You you know, it's one of those things where I hate to hear myself recorded, but you actually sound much different to me when you go into your Barry White voice. I get a little weirded out, but you sound... I'm sure the ladies of Wall appreciate it.
I know. I know. So tell us about your week while I look this thing up, because I am not... Ooh, apparently... Darren Wilson, this mm-hmm. is just breaking. We're 4 o'clock, 4:30, recording this podcast on Tuesday, the 25th of November. And Michael Brown is speaking to ABC and a preview of an interview that he's doing tonight. And Wilson said that he feared for his life because the teen reached into his car and grabbed for his gun, which is consistent with what we've heard he said. Wilson said he was sorry that Brown had died, but he would not do anything differently that day. He did what he was trained to do. He was simply doing his job. Asked if Stephanopoulos asked if it would have gone down any different if Michael Brown were white. Absolutely not, Wilson says. He has a clean conscience. Jezebel's Kate Drees, who first pointed out details of the interview, asserted that racist tendencies are so deeply ingrained in Darren Wilson's mind that he can't even acknowledge them. Okay.
Who is she from? Jezebel?
Jezebel, yeah.
Hmm. I'm not
Jezebel is a Gawker site. It's their den of feminism.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So that would be why you're not familiar
no,
with it.
No, the Feminazi Gawker. I understand.
It's actually a really decent site. There's a lot of interesting stuff on there.
It sounds like the internet version of The View.
Yeah, no, you'd hate it. I like it.
Uh-huh.
As you know, I am at heart, ladies, a feminist.
Yes.
So we had a couple, in the last podcast we said, hey, we're not putting out as many this year. A lot of you have gone back and listened to the catalog. Write on our wall, send us an email, let us know what you think the evolution of those of us on this program have done. Well, one person did that. One. Which is one more than I thought would actually do that. And it's Blake Bowen, so shout out to Blake. Blake writes, I went back and listened to all of the old podcasts. I didn't notice that much of a change in Greg or Spangle. Maya's more annoying. But what really got me interested in the old shows was when I discovered Creighton. That dude was just so brilliant and passionate. Plus, he's really fun listening to him put Galt in check. So, translation, Greg, you're fired. I have to bring back Galt and Creighton.
That works well. Yeah. That works well. It's a busy winter. And it's only a matter of time before Galt does something on his reappearance that I'll be asked to come in kind of like a middle reliever for the We Are Libertarian show.
Creighton and Galt, the second season, shall we call it, the reboot, would probably not last very long. Although, listen, in fairness, we've done this podcast for darn near 3 years. Three?
Well, so...
Yeah, 2012.
March, yeah. It'll be 3 years.
So, he may have grown. We'll find out.
He has been in the corporate world, and that tends to sort of take some of the warts off of the... of your, I guess you could say, cultural eccentricities.
You know what's funny is the show has grown so much since Galt left that, like... maybe 100 of our 2,000 listeners have any clue who we're talking about.
And, I mean, I loved Galt just because he was the wrench in the gear of Wall. Like, it was fantastic. You didn't have to do anything. You just sat back and watched what would happen. And then, once the memes descended, he would spin himself into a frenzy, and it was fantastic.
Not many people listening may even remember Creighton at this point. He's been in Washington for so long.
Yeah, but he will be back.
He will.
So, probably not the next show, but the one after, he'll probably be on, won't he?
Yeah, Creighton moved out to Washington, D.C. He's been working for YAL for the last
year
or two.
Correct you. He lives in Arlington, Virginia.
Oh, I'm excuse me.
He's a son of the South.
Dan Peffers, our very own entrepreneur. Dan moved out to Denver, Colorado to work in a dispensary. Now, here's what's funny about that. You know, we have forever joked about Peffers being a stoner. And he would say, guys, you can't say that on air. People are going to think I am a stoner. And we're like, you're high every time you're here. He's like, yeah, but I don't want people to know that. And then he moved and started working at a dispensary.
Yes, yes.
But both those guys will be back around Christmas time. So we'll have them on, and we'll see if we can't get Galt and Creighton on the same episode.
You know what? I bet you now, though, they're very much similar individuals.
Yeah.
I bet there are very few differences. Well, Creighton's really taken a turn for the, belt to the beltway right.
Yeah. We also just might as well do a cast update here. We'll have Maya back on soon, Harry too. I'm always in talks with Maya, but her writer to come on the show is a little ridiculous because I can only provide so much Red Bull and so much blood from an elected official for every time she's on.
You just sit around and wait for him to die, and you hope to God you're the first one to the hospital.
Oh, she likes freshly slaughtered. But our friend Suzanne, she is in Peru right now, and she'll be back in another month, so we'll have her back on. Speaking of feminists, and she has evolved, and so she does a lot of writing for Students for Liberty, too. So go check out Suzanne Schaefer's writings. Lynn's doing well. I haven't kept up with her too much. But Gina's doing really well. We've asked Gina to come back on a couple times, and it just hasn't worked out. But we have not fired anybody.
No. Do you think it's just people like sort of tire of us?
Well, one person we fired. Well, two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we didn't really fire anybody. We just became so annoying that they left.
It's sort of like Office Space. Like, they were just like, you know, I'm just not going to go anymore.
Yeah, exactly. So the core remains Joe Ruiz, yourself, and myself.
And we need to have Joe on.
Yeah, we do. Especially with this immigration debate. Sorry, too easy. So, poor Joe.
Yeah.
Joe is telling us about his racist experiences today.
Yeah.
He was being racist, but where people were being racist to him.
And then you took it upon yourself to bash that right the hell out of him.
Aww.
I actually was sitting there and I was like, you know, he's kind of opening up about this, you know, the actual experiences he's encountered and like that. And you're the first one to be like that Mexican guy with the big sombrero meme. Like,
he said,
Espen Lolo.
Oh, I did nothing of the sort. Joe's such a good dude.
Great guy.
So, and then Mittens is here. Mm-hmm. Muffins, have not kept up with Muffins. She's with the previous administration. And Cornelius continues to knock everything over in the house. So,
excellent.
That's your full cast update. And I know we're forgetting somebody. There's so many people. So many people have been here through the 90-some episodes of We're Libertarians. Either is
Paul Gable.
Paul's the editor of his local newspaper.
There you go. You know.
So still has never been on this program, and by God, will never be on this program. Some of you might remember there was a time where like Paul was like, I really want to come on, I really want to come on, I really want to come on. And we just kind of turned it into a little inside joke. Finally, I said, all right, dude, I feel bad because you're not kind of getting the joke. Come on the show. I invited him 4 episodes in a row. Turned me down. Said, no, I don't want to be on your podcast.
You Matt Damon'd him.
I totally did the Matt Damon to him.
You did. And it was wonderful.
It was hilarious.
Oh, you know who we forgot? It's Ryan Ripley.
Ryan's up in Fort Wayne. He
doing well.
Got a new job, and he's doing fantastic.
Seems to really, really like it and, you know, embraced his upper middle class lifestyle very well.
And was fighting with Joe on Twitter the other day. So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Very true. Very true. Well, how's that, though, for a Wall State of the Union?
Yep. Very good. So that's your year-end review here on We Are Libertarians. All the people that we are thankful for. All the people.
I'll let you handle that.
And Galt.
Yeah.
Oh, biggest update of them all. James Neese. Some of you may remember James Neese from the one episode he was on. The biggest freak amongst us. in a good way, I guess. He's a dad now.
He is.
He's a dad.
His internet trolling has almost disappeared since his son, or his son?
I don't know. He doesn't either.
I know this, that kid will be baptized in liberty. Well, since it is right on the precipice of Thanksgiving, shall we? I know sometimes you like to talk about that, and other times not so much, but last year, I believe, you did a little spiel on the real Thanksgiving story.
Did I?
I believe so. When they came over here and ate a couple Indians?
They did. It was full cannibalism. As soon as they got off the boat, the pilgrims got off the boat, they prayed to Jesus, and then started eating Indians, left and right.
Well, the Lord provides.
Right. No, you know, what I'm always, and we invite you to go back and listen to that episode, because I'm sure I was far more eloquent last time than I will be this time, but, you know, every year I always, you know, granted, it's the Super Bowl of eating. I am very excited about that, even though I am a slender...
You are a svelte spangle.
...dear leader. I love to eat still, all right? I ate, like... 2 giant fajitas before you got here, and I'll eat as soon as you leave.
But are they like soy organic?
No, I'm eating all my processed foods, so things are.
You've normalized.
Yeah, things are going really well right now. And then as soon as I get back to the organic vegetarian diet,
ugh,
I'm gonna be such a bitch. But so. One thing that I always try to think, because everybody wants, oh, let's thank the soldiers, let's thank all the public servants, and listen, we support our soldiers, we don't have a problem with that. Maya does, we don't. but it really is one aspect of Thanksgiving that I think always gets lost, that is missed, is the effort that it took to build this country. You know, the effort that went into building the American society, for good and bad, you know, the just getting on a boat and going to a place you've never seen and you have no idea. It takes
one there waiting on you to.
No,
they're made. You know, you don't know what the food's going to be. You don't know.
You don't know if you're going to ever see land again.
Yep.
You know,
it just as like actually probably more likely that those boats sink.
Right. So I always want to remind people around Thanksgiving. It's like, take this opportunity to think about how much effort went into the building of the American experiment. And on the flip side, how easy it is to let that slip away. And boy, are we doing a really good job of losing all the founding values that went into that, into the pilgrims, into the, you know, and that founding generation. And the hard work, industriousness, entrepreneurship, self-reliance,
good luck.
Just
a lot is, you know, a lot of it's good luck that, mm-hmm. that we were even able to. How many colonies have been able to successfully have a revolution, establish governance, not fall prey to a collectivist urge, and essentially be longtime the best of allies with the people they revolted against.
Yeah, and I think we ought to segue into our discussion about immigration here. It also is a great example of people living peaceably, because here the pilgrims come to this country, they're on the verge of death, they're barely making it through, they have no idea how to farm the ground here in North America, because they're used to European techniques and their soil and their climate, and they are saved by the Native Americans and teach them how to farm. Huh? Yeah. That didn't go on air. I'll edit that out later. But they were able to initially live peaceably with each other and help each other, and two very different cultures who had very little ability to communicate to each other. And, you know, maybe we're painting a rosier picture of the Thanksgiving dinner than we'd like of those early settlers, but
But think about it. If you look at like what Stephen Hawking believes, if like the Earth, like, you know, the current world right. were ever to be approached by aliens, it would be hostile and awful for humankind.
Right.
I think that may be, you know, slightly different, obviously, because it'd be a different being. But so if it, imagine just someone showing up on your shores, which is really no different than what goes on in the current immigration debate today. Mm-hmm. Is there crime? Yes, obviously. I mean, there's always going to be bad actors in any collective group. There's always going to be the, you know, the person that acts outside the norms or isn't appreciative of what's been handed to them. But they accepted them in, they showed them the ways, and it was, it's a testament to humankind outside the bounds of governance.
Well, it's a fundamental question that you have to ask yourself. Who owned the land when the pilgrims stepped off the boat? Nobody. And so they homesteaded it. And then that property became theirs. And that is the way that property is either laying fallow and nobody's using it and nobody's claimed it. And so you homestead it or you improve it and it becomes yours because you put your labor and effort back into it and your resources into homesteading it. And so that piece of property becomes yours. Or you trade or buy for it. You trade currency. You trade another piece of property. You trade beads. You trade whatever. You know, let's say a podcasting equipment were the new currency of the new world, then I would buy you outright, Greg.
You would purchase me and make me be your editing slave.
So the pilgrims, the Indians didn't own the land when the pilgrims got off the boat.
They couldn't even comprehend that concept.
Right.
How can you own the land? They exactly. lived off the land.
Right. So it is our notion, the European notion, even though I'm partly Native American, I guess I shouldn't say are. Oh, such an Anglophile, jeez. But the European, the Western culture brought that idea of...
Property rights.
And I think that libertarians, a lot of times, I know that I certainly have gone way the opposite direction from my Republican days in this. I was listening to the debate earlier, and I was thinking, I don't really care about borders in any way, shape, or form. You know, if somebody wants to come here and work and trade their personal time and labor for a currency, who am I to say otherwise? What harm does it do to me? In fact, great, because they move into my community, they start earning a living, they start...
buying my things that I produce.
They start buying things that I produce, and therefore it helps me. It helps the supply chain here in Indianapolis. So why am I getting mad about the idea, the false idea, of an imaginary line being drawn by a government that I don't even like? So, you know, that is, in a lot of ways, the distillation of the libertarian view is when you start to restrict anything, when government starts to set limits on
growth,
how humans move, how
cultural norms,
how rivers move, how food moves, how humans move, how economies move, when the government starts to restrict things, they are like a giant dam in the middle of that river that plug up everything else, and there's all these unintended consequences. And if we just had a little spontaneous order, it would work out a little bit better. It'd work out with less unintended consequences, while most of the time, I think, people in government passing laws, if they aren't motivated by money, they're motivated by decent interest a lot of times. I've been around government a long time. I haven't met a lot of people who are just outright awful people. And I think we're too easily demonize people who work in government. It's like Van Jones said about police officers last night in the middle of the Ferguson stuff. It's like, my dad was a police officer, my uncle was a police officer. Guess what? They're human beings. They're prone to error. They're just regular people. They're not angels. They're not devils. They're just people. And that's how most people in government are. And they think they're doing the right thing. They're just wrong.
Yeah. You
know? So I tend to look at the immigration debate as the government restricting spontaneous order. the free flowing of human beings. Now you, scumbag Republican Greg Lenz, maybe we ought to ask you to summarize what's actually happened. I just started ranting a little bit.
Oh, no. No, you're fine.
But I think when you move, when you come into, when you use the notion of the Indians and the pilgrims got off the boat, entered a land that nobody was using, set up their own homestead, put their work and labor and effort into it because it was their risk-reward. They were risking their lives, or they were going to be rewarded with freedom, which is nobody telling them what to do. They didn't know anybody.
Essentially, they were escaping government persecution.
Exactly right.
That's what they were really doing.
They wanted the freedom to worship in the way that they saw fit.
They were the OG libertarians.
Right. And it was up, you know, it was up to them. Risk, total risk reward. And that means that they're going to put all their effort into it. But they weren't, you know, it wasn't until another society, another community came in and said, hey, let's help you make your life a little bit better. Let's have our two communities work in harmony, that their society improved, and hopefully, well, maybe the Indian society didn't
improve. It got much smaller, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It got more, should I say, contained.
My bad. So, anyways.
History always, you know, goes to the winner.
Right. So, why don't you give us an idea of what the president has said and done and what is happening in the immigration debate, and then you give your analysis of it while I clear my throat. Greg?
Sure. So what's going on right now is that, as everyone probably is aware, even though Ferguson is definitely the news story that's dominating the news cycle, is that President Obama decided to act unilaterally on his own without Congress. He is not going to wait for legislation. He is going to go ahead and use executive order to not necessarily create de facto amnesty, but he is going to exercise the power to the extent he possibly can and thinks he can stay just right up to the line of the Constitution. And that's a really, really, I mean, he's at the point of flirting with a thin line, because what he's essentially doing is looking at the executive order clause and the necessary and proper clause of the Constitution, and he's going to shield deportation of illegal immigrants and offer them the ability to apply for work permits, because he can sort of categorize and create a hierarchy of what groups can and cannot be deported, who should be, who shouldn't be. And it really, the precedent was set by executive orders from Ronald Reagan and then continued on by the Family Fairness Act from George H.W. Bush.
Sure. And actually, Obama, up until this point, has deported more people than George W. Bush.
Oh, he is the great deporter.
Right.
And so that's something to keep in mind as well. And he is, part of this is, he is a constitutional, you know, lawyer by training. So he's going to have a pretty good idea of what his basis is, and then he had it reviewed by the Department of Homeland Security's justice, and then he had it reviewed by his own another attorney within the administration, and so they think he's within the law. And it's funny, even libertarians like Justice Napolitano has even said realistically he is acting within the, you know, within the bounds of the Constitution, because it's so vague.
Okay, what was Napolitano's reasoning?
His reasoning is that he has this ability because of the vagueness of the clause. So the president can't just halt all deportations, and that's not what he's doing. He's prioritizing them. And so he's going to use a provision in the immigration law called deferred action. What that does is it formally protects particular immigrants from deportation, those with families here. And he can create, like I said, this hierarchy. And by doing that, once they're considered a deferred or categorized group, then they're eligible for work permits. And so he can continue granting them the ability to stay here as long as they work with work visas.
Right.
That's pretty tough, because that's really what the existing institutions are designed to do. You know, Department of Naturalization, that's their what they do. Department of Labor, they issue these work visas. And now the president's getting into that business. And so it's a lot of administration for the executive branch to have.
Right.
And so it's a really, really difficult I'm torn by it personally because part of me says, absolutely, let's bring them in. You know, they want to come here. That's what else could you want as a fellow citizen, as people that want to be a part of what you've created or where you live, want to be productive members of society. You know, the evil, or not the evil, but the individuals who want to keep people out are so fearful of the Mexican, or, you know, the drug wars, the drug trade right on the border, right. ISIS coming into the United States. I guess they found like 150 or 200 ISIS flags right outside a border crossing.
Okay, but let's talk about what actually this means. Does this mean that they're not going to patrol borders, that they're not going to be border security?
No.
Or is this, does this mean that the people that they catch, the people that are, you know, INS is breaking, let's be honest, I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately about, you know, the food supply in this country, and it is a lot of Hispanic labor.
Yeah.
And there's a couple documentaries where they show them being deported. They go and it's a weapon that one farm will use against another farm, or one company will use against another company. They'll you know, call in an INS report and have people deported. People that have been known by INS for 20 years, but somebody called, so we got to do something now.
You know? Now we got to enforce the law, right, because it's documented.
So if it's those people who have families and have been here for 20 years and have roots, and we're not breaking up their families, fundamentally, what's the big deal versus we're not going to patrol the borders anymore?
Oh, yeah. It's totally different. Those are two completely different things. And so what he's saying is that those that are here and do get caught now can apply for a work visa indefinitely. And until immigration gets passed, some sort of law that offers a path to citizenship, now they no longer have to be fear, you know, live in that fear of being caught or being reported and then having to go across the border and then get back in to see their family.
Right.
So this is ultimately being portrayed on the right as the president has just gone and declared everybody's a citizen.
Right.
Which isn't the case, it couldn't be further from the truth. And
is he saying that until a bill is passed, this is the way that the administration will handle this?
Absolutely.
Because you haven't given us clear direction?
That's exactly what he's saying. Is he saying, I mean, I believe him when he says he would love to have a law that gets presented to him that he could sign and we could establish a path to citizenship that isn't, I promise I will learn and speak English and have it tested, you know,
right,
something ridiculous. But people fear immigration on the right. A lot of the, and I'm not going to say it's even the Christian right, it's not even the neocons, I'm really not sure who exactly it is. I think it's just older Republicans. And I think it's older Sunbelt state Democrats, too.
It is the old Dixiecrats.
It is. It's Strom Thurmond.
Right. It's the son of the George, it's the son of the George Wallace generation.
Yep.
Let's call it what it is. I mean, if you really get down, if this were about British people,
yeah,
I don't think there'd be near the rhetoric that there is.
No.
To be frank.
There wouldn't be a discussion of this at all.
Right.
And any economist will tell you that right now it is incredibly beneficial, especially for food prices, that this labor supply exists.
Was it Alabama or Mississippi that a couple years passed an immigration bill? And their entire, like, they were begging illegal immigrants to come back into the state.
Alabama.
Yeah. I wish I could give people more details so they can go look that up. But, yeah, to the point that the governor was saying, we got to repeal this because our farms can't find enough labor.
Absolutely.
Everybody went to Texas.
Exactly. They went to Texas, and then that further boosted Texas economic growth and makes Rick Perry look like, you know, the economic god that has the Midas touch, when really what drives economic growth is increase in population, and then you can either get it from productivity gains, like through technological innovation, but all those new consumers spur growth, which spurs, and I'm going to sound like Paul Krugman, and I don't mean to be, but I'm saying that they buy things, they earn money, they work hard. And so when illegal immigrants flood into your state, all of a sudden, It's a boon because they're working and they're purchasing things, and then it makes Social Security look like it actually could be funded for a little bit longer.
The other reason that there is so much animosity towards immigrants, there was a book by Rick Bragg about the collapse of the Alabama cotton industry and the textile industry, to be more accurate. Gosh, I wish I could remember the name of that book, too. But Rick Bragg, B-R-A-G-G, my favorite author, all over but the Shoutin's, my absolute favorite book. And think it's like the best they ever did or the best they ever had or something along those lines. And it talks about the collapse of the textile industry in the rural South. And, you know, my dad ran a janitorial company. My dad ran a business that in the 1980s and 90s cleaned all the Bank One branches, now Chase, in Indiana from Kokomo to Bedford to Terre Haute to Richmond, which basically is most of Indiana, except the extreme north and south. Lot of employees, almost all of them are white, lower income working people, mostly from trailer parks. All of those jobs that my dad had don't exist anymore. They were, you know, they went to a larger nationalized corporation, not nationalized in the sense the government owns it, but a national corporation that didn't do background checks on immigrants, and those jobs were taken by cheaper labor.
Yep.
And now there's just now those people can't find a 35, 40-hour a week job, you know, because those jobs are disappearing. There's only so many slots at places like McDonald's. The textile mills, and the documentary, The House I Live In, kind of makes this point, is that what becomes the next quick income-generating industry for the rural South, for the lower white income brackets that we're talking about, it becomes the drug trade.
Yeah.
And so that's why you see prescription pills, the number one, it's like massively spiked, the number one arrested inmate population now is younger white females from rural areas. And now we're talking about broad population strokes here. On an individual level, I don't give a crap that the industry in your town dried up and went away 20 years ago. You know, because if you're a 22-year-old female, that's not an excuse. If you're a 28-year-old male, that's not an excuse to just not have a job or not go, you know, move to a different place. You know, move to an urban center where you have more jobs. Easier said than done, I understand that. But I think that there is, once you kind of take a look at that trend, you see a lot of, you understand the animosity a little bit better just outside of racism. Obviously, there's a racist undertone, but there's also an economic undertone brought in by things like NAFTA and government economic policy that have destroyed those industries.
And that's the real issue, because it's really easy to talk about immigration in the form of, well, yeah, of course, people want to come here, let's have them here, right? You know, but then we strike things like NAFTA. Then we have a government that controls our currency and controls its value relative to other countries. And so unless it's a true equal playing field, like in the United States, a lot is said about, we don't have cheap labor. A lot of that is a question of currency. It doesn't mean we don't have the work ethic and productivity of China. It means that for our currency is the world's global standard and backbone for right now. And because of that, that means that it has to be more stable. It is more valuable in relation to countries that are less developed. And so when you factor in that they have an inherent advantage because it's just purely cheaper to get have goods made in a foreign country and then including shipping costs, is it really a fair play when you can't even influence who the head of the Federal Reserve is? You can't,
right?
You know, It's just such a nuanced issue, because you can get hit no matter what your stance is. You can get hit from every side. You can get hit from, well, the individuals that came here and did 9/11, they were able to come here. They were able to take flying classes. They were able to kill 3,000 Americans. Are you really want to have that on your conscience?
Right.
I mean, I agree wholeheartedly. It's just so difficult to put into practice because you open yourself up to such holes where if anything goes wrong, you pretty much you don't have a choice. You have to come out on the other side. Because would you like to go to the funeral of those that you allowed in?
Right. No, yeah, but isn't that sort of a scare tactic to say that by selectively, it's not a mass blanket amnesty. That's not what,
no,
what it sounds
no.
like.
But that's the politics of it.
It's more case by case by case, as opposed to the scare tactic, which is, listen, you're going to let Al-Qaeda and ISIS in here, and then we're all just going to die.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Which is not really, you know, under the existing immigration policies. Who were the two jackasses with the bombing in Boston?
Weren't they, oh, the Sarnoff brothers.
Yeah, weren't they Americans, or they were Chechens who...
They're Russians, yeah.
But hadn't they lived here their entire life?
Yeah, they just... Well, the older one had gone back and trained with Chechen rebels.
Right. So, under current immigration policies, there's two homegrown terrorists.
Well, yeah, I mean, then you look at Timothy McVeigh.
Exactly,
you look at
America. Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great soundbite.
Sure.
And it dominates, you know, it dominates how the two sides think about it. But, I mean, regardless, we should want people to come here.
Which, again, that scare tactic is steeped in 20 years of racial propaganda, racial bigotry, and propaganda used to basically help prop up wars that maintain...
that we initiate.
That maintain oil and other energy interests.
Yeah.
You know...
Without a shadow of a doubt. And, you know, obviously, the libertarian in me says, do it, get it done. The president's doing the right thing, but the dangerous part is the president setting this precedent. This is a terrible precedent to set because he hasn't used a lot of executive orders. But what he's doing, in fact, and up until now, it really hasn't been done, is if he doesn't agree with something, he's refusing to enforce it.
Right.
Or finding a way to circumvent it, which... Man, you talk about, you know, he's kind of acted that way regardless. It was like the healthcare bill. Well, I don't really need any bipartisanship. I don't need Republican votes because I've got 60 and I've got, you know, a majority in the House.
Right.
And that's great, except that it won't always be the case.
Well, I'm sure once we get a Republican in there, they'll restore the balance back to the true meaning of the Constitution. Right, Greg?
Oh, no. Because, you know, this thing is, it's like blowback. Like, if you're going to do it, we're going to do it 10 times worse.
Right.
You know, and look at the history. So I've got a little history on executive orders. Republicans love to talk about Lincoln. That's their Trump card on racism.
Yeah, it's John McCain's favorite.
Lincoln.
Yeah.
Lincoln.
Right.
You know, but regardless, executive order, he issues the suspension of writ of habeas corpus and the Emancipation Proclamation during the Civil War. FDR he invented the executive order. He acted and used it more than anyone else, including he issued one in 1942 that led to the Japanese Americans internment camps. Truman integrated the army with the use of the executive order. Again, a case of probably the right thing to do, but if you don't do it legislatively, you're just asking for other people to abuse it for what they support and for their views.
Sure.
You know, and I just, you know, I look at it and I think, yes, I agree with President, you know, President Obama. We feel the same way on immigration, but God forbid Ted Cruz ever gets a hold of it.
Yeah.
I mean, all of a sudden... He'll issue an executive order banning homosexuality, and you have to go to same-sex attraction disorder seminars.
Yeah, but it's never that. I mean, yeah.
It isn't, but you know what I mean?
It's always, it's so much more veiled. Even, like, if you go back and look at the writ of habeas corpus in Lincoln's time, you read the situation, you read the circumstances surrounding it, you read the order itself, and you go, I could see why... At that time, in this way, that makes sense. And then you go, but wait a minute, did I just say that?
For
you know
sure.
What I mean? It's always that way. It's never like Ted Cruz signs an executive order to burn all gay people.
No,
you know, it's
but we
never,
did in turn Japanese,
you know,
Americans.
It's always a slight, and it's the boiling of the frog. It's always a little bit slower until the temperature gets hotter, and it's been going on for 150 years.
In the FEMA crowd of the libertarian, you know, of the libertarian strain, established by executive order.
Right.
It's those awful uses, and then, yeah, but, you know, and then you encounter someone in an argument, and you say, listen, it was established by this, they have this power, doesn't mean they've used it, but it exists, and you can, you know, maybe you can imagine a hypothetical where that actually happens, where we go to, quote-unquote, FEMA camps, but at the end of the day, no.
But all dystopian nightmares, which, let's be honest, most libertarians live in a dystopian, disconnected universe, not most, a lot. That we run into, right, listeners? Not any of you, them.
Those people.
Those people, not you, great listener. But there are a lot of people who have this dystopian notion of the world and the way that it operates, and I'm not going to say that things aren't bad, but we're doing a podcast right now. And
it could always be worse.
We've done 93, four episodes about how much the government sucks. I made a career out of it. I made a living doing that. You know, it is not a dystopian nightmare. Could it be? Absolutely. Could it not be? It absolutely could not be. It could be our choice, you know, and every dystopian nightmare, there's always the one figure. There's the Hitler, there's the Stalin-like figure in the Mockingbird, whatever, with the chick with the naked photos.
Hunger Games,
that girl. You know, there's Donald. There's the guy that showed
Donald
his ass.
Sutherland.
Yeah, showed his ass in Animal House. That guy. It's always the guy who shows his ass in college that ends up being.
Well, he was the professor,
right?
Now, would anybody like to smoke some pot?
So, you know, I know, and that this plays into that, and that's what drives me crazy. I was thinking about this the other day. You know, libertarians. And that's why I think we have gained an audience for as inconsistent as we have been this year. The key to growing your podcast, the number one rule is consistency. I do this, like, my job is new media for a major radio show. I know new media. The number one job is consistency. We have been terrible to you, dear listener, about that over the last year. But I think the reason that we have gained an audience and grown over the last year is because every other libertarian podcast or media outlet doesn't give you solutions. They don't tell you what's an alternative. What's the solution? They tell you, well, see, this is just another example of how bad things are getting. And here's the gold and the prepper package that I'd like to sell you. And here's why you need to buy more ammo, because the end is near. Like, yeah, of course it could be, but it also could be the other way too. It could also, you know, we could also pull this thing out of the ditch. So,
and I think that plays is an excellent segue into Ferguson.
Okay.
Because you stayed up for a good way longer than you usually do last night.
Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Watching the event. I was amazed how late you were up. And I watched Ferguson, and I really tried to keep a really good watch of how people were responding within the Liberty Movement. And there seemed to be just some irrational exuberance for the protesters.
Right.
And so that's why I really felt moved last night. I don't know if you read it, because you may not even had time today. I wrote a piece last night, you know.
Where did you post this piece?
On WeareLibertarians.com.
Never read that piece of shit.
Yeah, that website's awful. It doesn't load. Yeah, I wrote it on there because I was watching it, and I thought, there is no way this improves liberty for anyone in that community.
Right.
There is no way. And then a friend of mine, you know, made a comment, and I wrote about it, that when will we get beyond the color of our skin? And I thought, well, obviously, when it stops being profitable, when it stops being able to let Al Sharpton get his own MSNBC show, when Jesse Jackson, you know, in the instance that Jesse Jackson and racism ever are over, that man's unemployable. You know, these guys, they deliver votes. They deliver voting blocks. They are able to incense people and get them to show up at the polls.
I saw a guy with a megaphone, and it was a well-worn megaphone, and it was branded.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I don't know anybody with a microphone with their personal branding on it to promote their activism business whatever it is. You know what I mean?
Yeah, their citizen journalism. So it was a bad situation, in my opinion, the way that the way that a lot of the more black and yellow crowd, and even some more of the establishment crowd of the Libertarian Party, was reacting to protesters.
And by said, black and yellow crowd, you mean voluntarists?
Yeah, the anarchists, the people that were inspired by the way protesters were reacting to the police state. And that's great, but ultimately now, all this talk that had been done about the militarization of the police, it's licensed to go and request more. Look at Ferguson. I already saw two articles today from highly respected left or progressive, or The Nation and The Atlantic, saying we really need to make sure that this 1033 stays. I forget what, if it's an amendment that allows it to stay open, that they can request any of the excess military vehicles and arms. We need this so Ferguson doesn't come to your town.
You're kidding me.
Oh, no. And these are highly respected civil libertarian websites.
Now, let me for those who aren't familiar, there's a program that allows that all these... We've spent a decade and a half building up our war machine. And now that is kind of winding down and we're leaving Iraq and we're leaving Afghanistan, there's all this surplus of weapons that didn't make it overseas that are just sitting and rotting on military lots. And so the military said, well, we got to do something with it. Why not give it to local police departments? And so, you know, like the town of Lawrence, which is inside the Indianapolis city limits, so they have all the necessary... I mean, it's in the middle of Indianapolis. They're just their own incorporated town. They got this big mine-resistant vehicle.
MRAPs.
An MRAP for free from the military. All it cost was like...
Yeah, they have the maintenance costs.
I think they cost like $3,000 or $4,000 to have it painted. And they got it for free. What the hell does a town of 20,000 people in the middle of the 12th largest city in the nation, which has their own MRAPs that they could call in and be there in 10 minutes, what do they need a mine-resistant vehicle for?
Well, didn't you watch last night? That could come to Lawrence, and then right. We would need that sort of reaction to make sure that we can keep the public order.
Sure. You know, the police told the media and all the protesters there last night, listen, we've done all this training. We don't need tear gas. We're not going to use flashbangs. We're not going to use tear gas. You're all, you know, we're going to be peaceful. We have gone through all this extensive training. So don't worry. As soon as it breaks out, tear gas, flashbangs, you know.
And did they lie? Yes. Did they say they weren't using tear gas? It was smoke to clear out areas? Yeah. But unfortunately, CNN was recording and one of the reporters got hit by tear gas.
Right.
You know, another one got a rock in the head.
The brother of the governor of New York.
Yeah. Which, if there was ever a guy to get hit by tear gas... Not saying it's always a bad thing, but he was just simply their reporter.
So you were saying you don't quite understand the glee that a lot of libertarians are taking in the chaos there.
No, because, you know, what's the point? What's the point of libertarianism? Is the point to actually create and improve liberty for everyone? Or is the point, are we just kamikaze pilots that can't wait to hit back at the police state?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what I believe. You know, I don't do this with a fatalistic view, and I know you don't. Mm-hmm. It's about how can we make small improvements? How can we... And even if you're... I mean, Maya's probably going to listen to this and literally probably throw tear gas in my bedroom.
But, nah, Maya doesn't listen to the show.
Well, that's true.
But, I mean, she was definitely one of the gleeful people.
Oh, she was ecstatic. Like, it's so wonderful. Like, you know, and, you know, that is one thing, because the protesters are different than the people who are looting.
Right.
There are two completely different groups of individuals.
Maya's argument, and you should definitely go to her Facebook page and check it out, and see her point of view from her words. But her point of view is the same as it has been on this program. My rights are being taken away from me. I am being aggressed against, so therefore it is perfectly acceptable for me to be aggressive back.
For sure. And if this is, you know, in her interpretation, it's probably the idea that this was a great example to watch and show what needs to be done to make improvement.
Mm-hmm.
I look at it and say, oh, dear Lord, our job just became that much more difficult because now they're just going to load up. Because
it's a bunch of people in Guy Fawkes masks. Which, if you're a libertarian with a Guy Fawkes mask, please just stop wearing it, because it at one time was like the cool underground signal. Now it's just like everybody has one, and it's just sort of.
Now it's been capitalized via a movie, and yeah. it's like a Che Guevara t-shirt. Like,
right.
It's the exact polar opposite of what it's supposed to represent.
The other point that Maya made that we shared on our Facebook page that I agree with wholeheartedly is, and we saw it from so many of our Facebook fans last night, oh, well, they don't deserve any rights or anything because they're just a bunch of looting bastards. It's like... No, like, mm-mm. If you really were watching last night, you saw that thousands were protesting.
They shut down a major U.S. interstate, you know, Interstate 44.
Thousands of people were there. They were peacefully protesting. And hundreds were looting.
Yeah.
And causing violence. And people, specifically, you know, communist elements amongst us, we have anarcho-capitalists. What are they? Camo anarchists?
Well, there's the libertarian socialists and there's the mutualists.
Right. And they even kind of, I mean, James falls in, you know, into close to where we're at, but I'm talking about the people who are like reading Che Guevara.
Oh, yeah.
And Lenin and Marx and going right on. And
the Bolshevik libertarians?
Right. Not even libertarians. I'm talking just straight up communists.
Yes.
You know, yeah. who want the collapse of the society because then they can, you know...
Re-educate mankind out of the ideological superstructure.
They take advantage of these situations because they can, and it helps further their... They want anarchy.
They think.
Right. So, I'm not talking about libertarians at all, although I'm sure there are plenty of anarcho-capitalist libertarians that are in Ferguson, like... throwing tear gas back, but you know, you watch a lot of the interviews with on YouTube with a lot of these Ferguson protesters, and the people that are the agitators that are outside, you know, causing trouble from the outside, are doing it because they're communists.
Oh yeah,
you know,
it is a overthrow of the existing norms, and they're taking back their rightful claim to property.
Right. So those people. Then to Mr. and Mrs. America around the country, give your average person who's just in the street pissed off and peacefully protesting a bad name.
Oh, if it's even me, it's like, I want a law passed and I want an MRAP keeping those people out.
Right.
Otherwise, I'm taking care of it.
Right.
They can talk about my property, but the second they try to take it, they can either, you know, get run over by an MRAP or they can be at the end of the gun.
Yeah, so I think we have to be careful about our own assumptions. So when you're looking at a situation like that, don't assume that every single person that is out in the street at Ferguson is a person that is trying to destroy property, because they're not.
No, and I mean, what happened to Michael Brown is a tragedy. You know, this is like this case with a federal grand jury not leading to an indictment is one in a million or 10 times more.
Yeah.
I mean, the facts are that the fact that this got brought to a grand jury, and because some people think the prosecutor punted on it and it didn't lead to an indictment, is really, it's a unicorn.
Here's a guy who has been in office since 1991, and I'm just guessing that the prosecutor of St. Louis, the city of St. Louis, effectively... He's been there since 1991. I'm guessing he's not corrupt at all.
No.
You know, nothing... You know, the longer a person is in office, especially in a powerful position like the prosecutor of St. Louis, obviously it's the county, but essentially for all of St. Louis, you know, you get more integrity as time goes on as you're in office. You start to rise above all those special connections and CD relationships that you might build. I'm being sarcastic. So
you were in uber troll mode last night.
Oh,
on
I
this.
Was.
You were.
This dude has to be the most corrupt. I don't know him. I don't know anything about him. I think his name is Richard McCullough. But I know local elected officials and they become drunk off their own power, and somebody who has been in office for 23 years is got, he just looks like a scumbag.
Just to give you an idea, so just in 2010, there were 162,000 federal cases before a grand jury. Only 11 of them didn't return with an indictment.
Right.
Whoa.
Essentially, the only way for there not to be an indictment, there's the old saying that a ham, you can indict a ham sandwich.
That was a, yeah, it was a New York State Chief Judge, Saul Wachtler.
Yeah. And something has to go terribly wrong, or the prosecutor has to not push for an indictment. And so what this prosecutor did is he basically just brought all this overwhelming evidence, dumped it in the laps, and then didn't present it in a certain way. You know when you have your review at work and you have to go to your boss and explain why you deserve a raise or how your performance was this year, you got to do a report. You have all the facts in front of you. Now, you could present the case as to why you should be fired. You could present no case at all and just give them the facts and let them come up with their own conclusion. Or you could present your best foot forward. Not presenting any case at all, just there's too many variables. I always like to put my best foot forward and explain why I am a great employee and I should be given a raise.
Unless you don't care.
Exactly. If you just don't give a shit, you just hand over all the documents and say, you guys figure it out, and you give them so many documents that they have to sort through it, and they all just kind of go, eh. But then you sprinkle in a few little facts of, you know, well, he is a police officer and blah, blah, blah. I mean, he didn't fight for it. He didn't frame any of it in any way, shape, or form. He basically did not care. If he wanted an indictment, he could have gotten an indictment, but he didn't want an indictment.
Not at all.
So I don't believe that I don't know what happened between the officer and Mike Brown. I haven't looked at all the evidence that was released this morning. I haven't had time.
If you want me to, real quick, it'll take just a couple minutes. I actually have the story.
All right, pull
his
up.
Testimony.
You know, pull up and we'll kind of read through it. But yeah. we kind of went through it on a past episode, and I think everybody's familiar with it.
But this is his testimony that actually sealed the no indictment.
Okay. All right. Pull it up.
Yeah.
But, you know, I haven't looked. Do you have it?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But I just, it to me, it doesn't seem like justice, the due diligence was done here.
No.
You know? In any way, shape, or form. Doesn't mean that I think that Michael Brown's the... In all of this, before we get into that, let me reaffirm Maya's principle of the binary. She loves to talk about not getting stuck in the notion of, you know, the false choice of one or the other.
Yeah, dichotomy.
Is it good or bad? Is John Wayne good or bad in this movie? Is this person evil or good? Is the cop good or the black kid bad? Is the black kid good and the cop bad? How does it work? Tell me, which way should I think? It's much more complicated than that. You know, in immigration, there's many more shades of gray than that. You know, the pilgrims and the Indians in our history, habeas corpus, all of it.
Except internment camps. Those were bad.
Those were bad.
I'm always on board with that.
I'm on board with that. The McRib, bad.
If FDR wanted it, it was probably bad.
Right.
So this is the testimony of Officer Darren Wilson. So at about noon on August 9th, he hears the radio that there's a theft in progress at the Ferguson Market. Suspect is a black male in a black shirt. Moments later, he sees the two young men walking down the yellow stripe in the center of the street. Says, hey, this is his recollection of events. Let me preface that. Says, he pulls over, hey guys, why don't you walk on the sidewalk? They refuse. We're almost at our destination, one of them replies. Wilson tries again. But what's wrong with the sidewalk? Wilson asks. And then things get weird. Brown's response, what's wrong with the sidewalk, as recorded by Wilson, is, sorry, I'm going to cuss, the fuck what you have to say?
Okay.
Don't know what exactly, you know. that point was. But so Wilson's the uniformed police officer in the police car, and Brown's an 18-year-old kid that just committed a robbery. And when asked to use the sidewalk, a guy that just committed a robbery, knows he's carrying cigarillos, says that to a cop. That seems like fishy to me. So anyway, though, it continues on. Wilson backs his car up and begins to open the door. And he says, "Hey, come here." He says it to Mike Brown. Brown replies, "What the F are you going to do?" And then Brown, in Wilson's version of events, slams the door closed. And Wilson tries to open the door again and tells Brown to get back. And then Brown actually leans into the vehicle and begins hitting him. So he landed two. And then when he got to the third one, he actually thought this could be the one. If he hits me just right, that could be the end. He testified that he felt like he was a five-year-old on the Incredible Hulk, holding onto the Incredible Hulk's arm, which, one, take his payback because he's an right. officer of the law. But anyway.
And I saw the pictures. The pictures of his injuries were pretty underwhelming.
You got hit harder by Maya that time she stormed off about public schools harder than Darren Wilson got hit in the face.
I did have an actual bruise.
That was legit. Yeah. And so that's what I immediately thought of. I was like, I've seen Spangle get punched harder over a podcast in public schooling than Darren Wilson. When he pulls him over, he says that. This goes on. He jumps into the car. Finally, this is where really Officer Wilson's testimony got off. Right as he's in there and has hit him twice, he stops, takes the cigarillos, hands them to the guy that's with him and says, "Here, take these," then goes back to start hitting him and try to land a third punch. Eventually, it turns into a struggle. He gets the gun. No, he's no longer, you know. He didn't carry mace. He didn't carry anything else. He just reached for the gun. It was the most natural thing. There was a struggle while it was near his pelvis, and then Mike Brown ended up getting shot. But the fact that he would stop in the middle of hitting a police officer inside a car after he committed a robbery with the stolen goods that are in his hand and say, "Here, would you mind holding these?" and then go right back to pummeling the officer, that almost seems like an SNL skit.
Right.
Like, that is, you know, I mean, granted, it does demonstrate the value of cigarillos, and that company should probably, you know, use that in advertisements, but it's just a really odd recounting of the way things went down. Not saying either side, you know, is lying. I'm not saying that Officer Wilson's lying. I'm just saying I know that in a skirmish, no one stops to say, "Here, these $4.99 cigarillos need to be protected."
Well, and you know, from your life events, things that happened months ago that were traumatic or heightened senses, you kind of convince yourself of the way things were as opposed to the way things actually happened.
Without a doubt.
You know?
It's only human, you know, it's only human nature. It's so foggy. And then you craft a narrative and sort of whittle away at it.
So what about the notion that there were a lot of these witnesses? I heard on the news that there were witnesses who were giving one testimony that favored Wilson, and then others that had been in the media, the others had not. These folks had been in the media, and theirs sided more with Michael Brown, and they were wildly discredited.
So the ones that were discredited were more to Michael Brown's side, and the problem was that none of them matched. They just weren't consistent ever. Who knows? One of them even went as far as to say that, like, THC killed him. Because the toxicology report showed that he was high.
Oh my gosh.
And that the pot he, you know, was gonna smoke and use the cigarillos for caused him to act outrageous, you know. And it's ridiculous. And I mean, ultimately the question is, Darren Wilson is walking away a free man, he killed somebody, and he's going around doing interviews saying he'd never acted differently and he doesn't have a bit of remorse. Someone should be remorseful. You killed an unarmed man, 18-year-old, getting ready to go to college, graduated from high school. By all accounts, no issues with the law ever, anywhere, period. All of a sudden, you robbed all that potential of him, and you don't feel any remorse at all?
Even George Zimmerman, who by now has been shown to be a crazy weirdo. I mean, this guy can't go 5 minutes without getting arrested. Was sad and crying and had remorse and, you know, same, you know, it just, yeah, that's a really good point that he doesn't have that.
He's acting sociopathic.
Right.
And whether he's been coached to do it or not, to be able to disassociate from the fact that the guy hit you in the face twice, and the immediate after pictures look like literally like you burnt your cheek with a curling iron. Like, that's the closest thing I can think of what it actually looks like.
It looked like he had a bad zit.
Yeah. Yeah, he had a monster teenage zit, and his girlfriend wasn't going to go to prom with him. Like, that's as bad as it was. And yet, he's feels completely justified in shooting him. And then, no one's even talking about they left the body to rot for 4 hours in the middle of the street.
Right.
In summer. I mean, where's the condemnation of the actions of the police department for their inhumane treatment of the corpse?
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that any of the evidence is any good when it's been essentially cooking like eggs on hot concrete in a St. Louis summer?
We had an incident here that's an infamous incident where a police officer was drunk and killed someone, Officer Bissard, B-I-S-A-R-D, if you want to look it up. And essentially what happened, I have on very good authority, and it ended up coming out and being true. They took his blood at one place. The cop did him a solid and took him to Hardee's to get him some food, sat in the police car and ate it. The cop kept the blood in his pocket and the body heat from the cop and then left it out. It increased the blood alcohol content in the blood to above the legal limit, and so the blood was thrown out. And, of course, now, because there was an improper handling of the evidence, you know, it got thrown out, but everybody's like, oh, the system is rigged against it, blah, 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 it's going for the cop. You know, well, no, if you were Officer Bissard, you'd want justice to be done in your name. But you have to be really particular with the way things are handled when it comes to evidence.
Exactly. And so since, I mean, any sort of toxicology report, anything like that, I mean, I'm not by any means a scientific expert, but it just seems like there should have been a whole lot more talk about contamination of the body, of the, you know, just leaving it there. For just one, just not covering it.
Yeah.
Dang, that just like...
really screwed up.
Oh, horrible. And that should be punished.
Just at every step, you know, and I made the joke last night that it's puzzling that local officials would make the announcement of the grand jury verdict at 9 p.m. when they have such an exemplary record of good decision-making up to this point. Just at every step, they're just boobs.
Oh, horrible.
Idiots.
Horrible.
This is the best and brightest that St. Louis has.
Well, I don't think anyone that's ever been around local governance would think that's... whoa.
Yeah.
That's where they put the guy that's been a party loyalist forever, where he can do the least harm, and then all of a sudden this happens on your community, and you're like, oh my God.
Oh, very, very accurate.
Horrible. It's like having Andrew Johnson as president, you know, shit-faced all the time.
All right, so let's wrap this up.
Yeah. I mean, how do you feel about it? Do you feel justice was served?
Honestly, you know, it is... here's the cynical, selfish part of me. This is one of those overblown Nancy Grace hyped-up things that I'm supposed to care about, that everybody's talking about, but it just is another long chain of government incompetence that doesn't surprise me at all. I don't feel like justice was served. I don't feel that the evidence was given a fair examination. My gut instinct, I don't believe that it was a racial killing. I don't believe that the guy just, you know, was like, I'm going to go out and shoot me a black kid today. You know, I don't think there was any of that calculation. If any part of it was racially motivated, there it would be subtle, you know, triggers. You know, racism has now gotten to the point where it's like, well, because of media influences, the blackface now, blah, 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 and you don't know that you're subtly being racist. You know, that's kind of where the discussion on Wilson has gotten. Like, it's no longer like, he's just an outright racist. Oh, we can't find anything. Well, because he's white, he's got these biases. I think that it's racially charged because it's a white guy killed a black kid.
Unarmed.
So I don't think that...
By all reports, a good kid.
Yes. So I wish the racial aspect were not a part of it, because I think what that does is that makes us focus on the wrong thing. the right thing to focus on is that a kid got the death penalty for bad mouth, you know, talking shit to a police officer.
If he did,
which we don't know.
And we won't know. And he was robbed of the opportunity to present his case as guaranteed by the Constitution.
And everybody just wants to believe the police officer because he's an authority figure. And that's what we've been told our whole lives. So,
I mean, to me, it's like almost impossible to not just feel total remorse for his family and for the chance to even have your day in court.
Yeah. And I, you know, on
that's the big travesty to me.
On some level, you feel bad for Wilson, too, because it's, you know, his punishment is that his life is ruined, just like Zimmerman. And I guess what I mean is that I hate the tabloid culture that we live in, where, you know, he's going to get a book, and he's going to get a book deal. He's going to get TV appearances and eventually speaking fees, and he's going to profit off of being some sort of weird, awful model and celebrity. His life is ruined, but it's not ruined. It's just different, good ways and bad ways. You know, he's like Joey Buttafuoco. He's going to be on a reality TV show in 10 years. You know, it's
like, he's PT, like, it's media that tabloid media has become P.T. Barnum. Like, yeah. Look at the bearded woman.
Right.
Like, you'll get paid well, but you're going to be laughed at because you're an absurdity.
Right. Yeah, he's just a disformed, disfigured, weird freak show now. You know, so you have to look at that and go, well, you know, here's a guy who probably wanted to be a police officer because he wanted to do good things, and now he's a freak show. You know?
Now, you know how I feel. I don't share that. After our discussion and you trying to get me to whittle a opinion down into a policy point in 50 words or less last night.
No, I'm all on board for your policy suggestion.
Are you?
Yeah.
Did I convince you?
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's a great idea. From a policy position, it's a great idea.
It's outside
position,
the box.
Yeah, it's outside the box. Should I say what your policy position is? Or will you?
I will. Okay. I will. Because it's really become to me, I mean, after seeing Radley Balco speak in the police state, it's really difficult for me because I easily separate military and, you know, domestic police forces whose sole job, in my opinion, is to protect me,
right.
Protect you. Not, I don't care about maintaining the public order. Like, that's branches off of protecting me. Slightly, but I don't want that to take priority. And so I don't like that police officers are what I consider hall monitors with guns that grow up and can't wait, you know, were the tattletales in third grade and couldn't report on what went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like we need a natural deterrent. We need a litmus test to determine people who actually want to protect the public good and out of a sense of duty and for wages. And we also need people who are willing to focus on what's important and not seatbelt tickets. And so the way to do that is how things used to be handled when Aaron Burr was vice president to Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton got a little bit mouthy one day at a state dinner or at a cabinet meeting. And so they settled it like gentlemen on the White House lawn. And then Alexander Hamilton was no longer Secretary of the Treasury. But
it is your contention that if you were pulled over, and
you should have the option for a mutually consented to voluntary gentleman's duel. There'd be rules. It'd be civilized. There'd be witnesses. 10 steps. Turn and fire. Because then that eliminates the police officer from the, I'm not sure he didn't have a seatbelt on, I'm not going to pull him over. Or the, he may have been going 6 over or 7 over, but I'm not sure. I'm not going to pull him over and see if he admits what speed he was actually going. It eliminates all of the indecision. It's going to be real crime by people who actually want to protect the public.
I think it's an interesting idea.
Zell Miller, a Georgia House of Representatives, he would challenge somebody to a duel in Congress.
You know, one thing that Balco mentioned in all that, and we posted that Radley Balco speech in the feed, so look back on past episodes. You know, he talked about it has shifted to now where if you get even the lightest bruise on your cheek, you are allowed to shoot and kill and protect your life at all costs, that you are guaranteed to return home that night.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that we must protect the lives of officers at
they
all
shoot
costs.
Dogs.
Yeah.
They shoot dog. Anyone that shoots a dog deserves to be on Bill Cosby's casting couch. In my opinion, because
oh, Bill,
you know, I just I love certain elements of the military, but man, like cops to me, just my personal interactions with them.
You turned into Suzanne all of a sudden.
You know, I try hard because I know there's good ones like Brad Rogers up in South Bend, and there are those that really do it for the right reasons. It's just the bad apples, just like the protesters in Ferguson,
sure.
They ruin everything.
I know, yeah.
And so I want a litmus test so they can't be in there, like a duel.
All right, well, let's wrap this up. Final thoughts?
You?
Oh, no. I went with our friend Woody. If any of you who listened to episode 92 and Rachel's story, I went with Woody to do a local podcast where he talked about Rachel's story again. And, you know, it was with a local lawyer, and he gave a lot of interesting perspective. So I'm going to put that in the feed once I get that edited up. You?
I was wondering if it was interesting because the government in that situation, you were really passionate about it.
Uh-huh.
It hit home. It was a local girl that was killed essentially by government mismanagement. And she sort of represented what you were talking about earlier in Alabama and some of the rural, more rural communities. And it really got you fired up. And uh-huh. Mike Brown never seemed to really be on the register for you.
I think the difference for me, excuse my voice, I'm losing it now all of a sudden. I think the difference for me is that Rachel made a bad choice, but in many ways, when you are a ward of the state, or when you are taken on by the state, and they are in charge of your life, they assume all responsibilities for taking care of you. And she was a helpless victim and had no ability, her family had no ability to save her. Mike Brown put himself in that position in... I don't know that that's... He certainly didn't intend to get himself killed. But I think that if you walk up to a police officer and start telling them they're fucking dicks, whether you think that they have the right to kill you or not, somebody, a human being, is standing there with a gun.
And he called him I left that part out, but I mean, he called him an effing pussy.
Well,
you're an effing pussy, you won't shoot me.
Grounds for murder.
It's like Biff Tannen and Marty McFly. Nobody calls me Yella.
For as much as our society would like to think that all police officers are wonderful and have all this training and self-control, I don't buy that. They're human beings with guns. And anytime that someone is standing there with a gun, they have the ability to kill you. And so generally, I'm polite to them. And if they ask me a question, I'm going to have a polite conversation with them. I'm not going to be aggressive towards them and tell them that they're a fucking pussy. And it's not even about disobeying orders from a police officer. It's just, why would you put yourself in that position? You know what I mean? Like, there's...
I know individuals, or I feel like I've encountered individuals who would do that.
Mm-hmm.
They also have track records. And so for me, that's like my biggest BS. I don't believe it.
Sure.
This guy, he just doesn't have a record.
Yeah. I'm not saying...
No, I know. So
I'm
like,
not saying that what happened to Mike Brown is right.
No.
I'm not saying that he deserved what he got, because that's not the case at all.
No, and just like watching you kind of like go down this path is what I went through.
I
was like, there's no way that Darren Wilson was telling the truth. I know people who are like... Or I mean, I've met people who would react like that. We've gone to high school with people who act like that.
Yeah.
They have records. They have a history.
Rachel didn't have the ability to make a choice for better health care.
No.
You know, Mike Brown had a choice to let it go or engage. And Mike Brown apparently chose to engage.
We think.
What I have found to be true in situations like this, kind of the big stuff usually floats to the top and is what happened. And it's all the minute, it's all the, you know, it's like the cigarillo stuff. It's like that kind of, I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like there's, you where there's smoke, there's fire. You know, you can kind of see.
He pushed the store owner, he took cigarillos.
So I don't think that, you know, clearly there was some sort of, it is just not probable that this cop got out of his car and started shooting at a kid walking down the street. There had to be some provocation for the cop to escalate it to a point where he killed somebody. You know, there had to be some provocation. I mean, that's just human nature. That's the way these events happen. Now, the details within that, I don't know. I'm not saying that I think Mike Brown was running at him or charging him or, you know, he clearly hit him or something hit him, you know, unless the cops at the end started banging his face on the steering wheel to get some bruises. But there would have been witnesses to that, I would think. So I don't know. That's, I think, why I look at it and I go, I'm not as fired up about this young man losing his life at the hands of the state because he had a choice to let it go. Whereas Rachel didn't have a choice to take the medicine she desperately needed.
Okay.
Am I out of bounds or crazy?
I was really just curious to hear it because it was kind of flipped for me.
Really?
Oh, totally. I mean, for me, it's flipped because she was there because she made a bad choice, mm-hmm. and she had her day in court and ultimately an unjust minimum put it there.
Sure.
With Mike Brown, he never even got to show up.
Sure.
And to me, that's the foundation of what justice is.
Right.
Instead, he got a flunky prosecutor that didn't care to actually have an indictment handed down, so he didn't.
Sure.
And that's what really, really bugs me, and I sympathize with just that wanting to just tear the system down because, well, we have nothing to lose anyway.
Sure.
Why wouldn't I just burn everything down?
In all of this, excuse me, I really become more passionate about just living my life and creating the things that abide by my libertarian principles and building my own, carving up my own little part of the world and living by these values and ignoring what the government and politics and the rest of it, what it does. You know, as I've kind of drifted away from being interested in politics over the last year and kind of rethinking every aspect of my life, it's like, you know, these big situations like this, it's like tabloid stuff. It's like, it's just.
They want me to click on it.
People are going to die at the hands of the state. And how much can you scream at the top of your lungs that this is right or wrong before, you know, how much work and effort can I put into it being right or wrong? I need to work on my own situation and live by my own principles and do what I can to kind of help further the cause, which is why we do this. But living and dying by this stuff anymore, it just wears you out. You know, I don't think I'm making any kind of sense.
No, I do. I mean, it's
you know, it just becomes
exhausting
and
self-defeating.
Yeah, it's how much more outrage can I spare? How much more can I be pissed off? How many more examples?
And what good does it do?
I'm kind of at a point where I go, all right, I'm selling all these books, and as I'm evaluating all these books that I own, I'm going, all right, this is a book about a problem. This is a book about how the government is broken. This is a book about how something went wrong because the government did it. It's like, I don't want to think about the government. I'm going to buy this book because it talks about, you know, these systems that will create an outcome using spontaneous order. I want to be more like Jeffrey Tucker, where what can be as opposed to what is the problem. And when I look at these situations like Mike Brown, and immigration and Thanksgiving and all the stuff that we talked about, there's this, just this thread, and you really start to see, you know, Western thought has a silo everything. Everything's compartmentalized, where really everything's a little bit more, has a little bit more of a harmonious balance to it, where one thing leads to another, which leads to another thread, which leads to another thread. And it doesn't make sense to be pissed off about police brutality only, because that has that's part of the drug trade, which is part of the prison industrial complex, which is part of this thing. You know, I could just spend all day being pissed off.
Exactly.
You know, and so I would just rather figure out, okay, in my daily personal choices today, how am I going to choose more freedom and support people who believe in the values that I have? It's like, I don't buy organic food because I'm a health nut. I still buy some non-organic food, but if the choice is between organic sour cream and non-organic sour cream, I'm going to buy the organic sour cream or the organic vegetables. You know why? It's not because I'm a health nut and that I think it's necessarily better for you, although it probably is. It's that I want to choose and vote with my dollar and send it to a smaller farm that I can trace back and send a message to bigger companies and the store that I'm buying at that says, buy smaller, buy local, buy fresher, buy healthier, and less of this processed crap. You know, I'm going to buy the organic milk that is $6 instead of the $4 milk and spend the $2 because I support what they're doing as opposed to a CAFO.
The almighty power of the market.
Right. You know?
Economics.
And so instead of spending all my time focusing on ways that I can tear something down and be pissed off about how my life isn't going well because of this, I think, all right, here's what I want to do today and here's how I can choose this. You know? So I just find myself being less outraged and more prone to not giving a crap about the government anymore.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're spying on me. They're going to war. It doesn't matter who, what politician I work for, vote for. That system's going to win. I'm just going to go participate in this system because hopefully the market will carry us this way.
It always does.
You know? I know I've, again, back to the food documentaries, but it's a great illustration. You know, where in Food Inc., they showed the guy who is the organic dairy producer who does all the sour cream. I think it's Stonywell or something. It's just all the organic milk and the organic ice cream and all that stuff. And he, you know, he's like, all my hippie friends say, how could you get in bed with the great evil empire? How could you get in bed? You know, we in the 60s, we fought against people like this. How could you get in bed with them? And he said, because it's easy. The choice is simple. When I'm outside of their system, they don't care about me. They're not listening to me. I'm fringe to them. But then when I came in and brought my product to them and they started carrying my product and consumers started buying my product, they started to go, there's money to be made here. And so they started looking at more organic alternatives to the point that now Walmart doesn't buy milk with growth hormones in it. Because so many people bought his product that in all their other products, he in the meantime convinced all the grocery buyers of Walmart, all the decision makers, that RGBH was bad for them and their children, that they just don't sell it, and they changed the industry.
That sounds a lot like changing it from the inside.
That's really weird, isn't that? Isn't that, Greg? That's weird.
Huh.
All right, so
peculiar.
Yeah.
No, but I'm glad. I was curious, and I'm glad that's where you kind of ended up.
Yeah.
Because that's I put that in chat this morning. That's just kind of what I'll end on is like I wrote that piece, and I was like, would you guys mind reading this and tell me if I'm just like the most white privileged a-hole on the planet and just have no idea of what it's like? And I thought, you know, ultimately, all this is a condemnation of government, because if that community had control, had their own council, had their own police, had their own governing rights, there'd be none of the alienation and Mike Brown still be alive today. And so if you are the advocate, if you are the Jesse Jackson, whatever your issue is, and you're out there yelling and screaming about injustices, how you're transgressed against, That's great. It's self-defeating.
You know what? People who are pissed off about the Jesse Jacksons of the world, really think about that impulse in yourself. It's that you just can't. It's a control impulse. You know.
Well, I'm not pissed off. I don't care about them. But what I do care about is results. And I'm so sick of just hearing about injustices. Show me how to fix it rather than making me sit there.
Sure.
And then, because it's all I'm going to do is, you know, it's actually how I ended it with Paul, or I told you about Paul Gable, is at a certain point, watching someone else be outraged just becomes fun.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're not going to win me over to your side regardless.
Yeah. I mean, when people sit there and complain about, you know, all these people, they're calling us racist. It's like, who's us? Are you the individual a racist? Or are you part of this group that is being labeled so you must fight for your group? You know, and your group just wants to control that group. It's like, I'm not a racist. I know I'm not a racist. I make choices every day to respect women, people that are different than me, the
gays.
You
respect each individual.
Right.
However that adds up in the collective, it adds up in the collective, and it's not your focus.
I don't respect people that don't deserve to be respected.
Nope.
You know, people look at me and go, why are you friends with Maya? You know, when she treats people, she treats groups so poorly. It's like, because as an individual, Maya is one of the best friends you can have on the planet. You know, and is actually a really good person. She's awesome. And if you weren't so tied up in trying to control her, or control society, or all the other control impulses and groupthink that you have, you'd probably see that. And Maya would probably treat you with respect because you weren't trying to control her, which is not possible. She's uncontrollable.
Yeah.
So.
No, but yeah, it's sorry this kind of dragged on, but I just wanted to hear you, if you went through the same process I did. But
that's all right. I ain't got nowhere to go.
We'll wrap it up and.
Yep, that's it for this episode of We Are Libertarians. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you soon. Thanks, and as always...
It's been too long if you can't remember the tagline.
It's been like a week and a half. As always, we promise...
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.